Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Jānān nabhayitabhaṃ ti. This evening, I would like to continue with the talk which I gave last week on the practice of Samatha meditation. In the previous week's talk, I mentioned about the foundations of the practice of meditation, the foundation of sila, of virtuous conduct to remove all possibility of remorse, and the breadth of that sila or virtue, the sense of even like self-esteem, which comes from keeping the regulations and the rules of the monastery, that lack of remorse which results from that. I also mentioned the practice of sense restraint throughout the day, bringing that particular practice into everything which one does, and also the practice of developing mindfulness and clear comprehension. And in the talk last week, I mentioned that mindfulness has two functions, and those two functions should be very clear to one. The first function is to inform you of what you are doing in the moment. This is sati in the function of clearly knowing the content of your conscious experience. And the second function of sati, which should be borne in mind, is just remembering what you are supposed to be doing. Remembering the instructions, remembering the Dhamma, which is also necessary as a part of the power which comes from establishing sati, mindfulness or remembrance. And once those qualities are well established, the mind has the ability to go forward in the process of meditation. And this process of meditation has the name at this stage called samatha, or tranquilizing, and it's tranquilizing anything which is a disturbance. And in this evening's talk, I wanted to spend a bit more time on those things which are actual disturbances to the mind. If one doesn't notice what a disturbance is, then very often one can take this to be a happy abiding. And if one takes that which is disturbing to be a happy abiding, one will never get beyond these disturbances and into the very tranquil states of mind, which we give the term jhanas. Again, this practice is samatha. It's quelling, calming, tranquilizing, getting rid of those things which we call disturbances. And the result of that is samadhi, samasamadhi, the jhanas. I will also just add here what I mentioned last week, the practice of samatha. Even though that one can put one's attention on the process and progress of meditation by judging it according to the degree of tranquility one has achieved, and thereby putting the emphasis on samatha, I need to mention categorically that samatha cannot occur without vipassana, and vipassana cannot occur without samatha, that these two go together as a pair. As one develops tranquility, one will automatically develop a clarity of mind which will give rise to the insights into the nature of your mind. In particular, if one's goal is towards the jhanas, to tranquilizing the mind, one will gain insight into those things which are obstacles to that tranquility. One will gain insight, clear knowledge and understanding of those things which we call disturbances. And if we develop the insight and we see these disturbances and we see their role, their function as obstructing us to the gaining of deeper states of mind and deeper states of clarity, we will let go of them. And the letting go of those obstacles, informed by insight, brings about samatha. When an obstacle, when a disturbance is removed, the result is greater peace. You've tranquilized, overcome, got beyond that disturbance. So vipassana and samatha will always go as a pair. But what are these obstacles which we have to overcome? And these obstacles the Buddha always described as the five hindrances. And these five hindrances are important to know. First of all, we know them just through study, through listening to a discourse. But then we start to see them in our own minds as we practice. And we should know that those things which are an obstacle to peace, which are an obstacle to clarity, these are called hindrances, niwarana. If the mind is not still, it means that there is a hindrance there, stopping tranquility. If the mind isn't clear, it means there's a hindrance there, stopping clarity. However, because there's a hindrance stopping clarity, it means there's no clarity. Because there's no clarity, one cannot see the hindrance. And this is a great problem for meditators, that the hindrances by their very nature can be so subtle, can be so devious, that we may not see them. We may not pick out that the mind still is bound up with a hindrance, and therefore we cannot see our way past that obstacle and into deeper states of mind. If, I will run ahead of myself for a moment, if the hindrances are all overcome, there is nothing between the mind and jhana. If the hindrances are fully overcome, all it takes is just a pointing of the mind onto one thing. A pointing of the mind onto the samadhi nimitta, which will be very clear, will come up as if an invitation to go in at this time. And all one needs to do is point the attention in there, and then one will enter. So a sign, one of the most clear and unmistakable signs that the five hindrances have been completely overcome and are no longer obsessing and obstructing the mind, is the ability for you to enter a jhana. If you find it difficult to enter a jhana, you can take it that there are some of those hindrances still there. Even though one might feel peaceful, even though one may think that one is concentrated, use the ability to enter a jhana as a test for oneself, a test to see if the hindrances are fully overcome or not. If you cannot enter a jhana, but you still feel peaceful, then look deeper. Look deeper and see what actually is left of the five hindrances. There will be something left there of those hindrances. And this is where one can uncover a deeper understanding, a deeper knowledge from experience of these things which we call hindrances. But let's go back to describe what these hindrances actually are. And as I'm describing these things, I'm going to go into, hopefully, a little bit more depth than you may be accustomed to. The first hindrance we usually just call sense desire, karma, chanda, sometimes it's put in the text as abhijja, covetousness. Even in the Samanyapala Sutta it said covetousness with regard to the world as the first hindrance, exactly the same as in the Satipatthana Sutta, or one of the things which one has to abandon before one even starts doing Satipatthana. But Kama Chanda is the usual description, even though Abhijja comes up many times. The majority of times the first hindrance is defined as Kama Chanda. The chanda, the desire, the will, that which finds satisfaction in the realm of karma. K long A, single M, A. This refers to the world of the five senses. The sense of eye, ear, the sense from nose, tongue and physical touch. It is not just seeking pleasure from these things, it is also seeking satisfaction from these things, seeking comfort from these five senses. And in the effort of the mind, in the journey of the mind towards this comfort or pleasure, it brings about what we call karma vitakka. These are the thoughts, the conjectures, the plans, which are all caught up with attaining comfort, well-being, pleasure in the realm of the five senses. In short, the realm of the five senses can be called the world out there. The world of the monastery, the world of your hut, the world of the lay people, the world of travel to different parts of Australia or the world. Everything which is concerned with the world out there. It even concerns the world of your physical body. This interface between inside and outside. And any thought, any conjecture, any plan, any movement of the mind in that area is called karma vitakka. And this is part of the first hindrance. You'll find that if the mind thinks, very often it is thinking in the realm of the karma loka, in the realm of the five senses, in the world out there or the world of the physical body. And this is part of the first hindrance. If this is the area where the thoughts are playing, there will never be any chance to free the mind from the first hindrance and to get to that samadhi which is the jumping off platform into jhanas. If one knows this, one should ask, why is it that such thoughts and such plans obsess my mind? It is because one seeks pleasure in these thoughts. One seeks comfort in these things. In essence, one is interested in these things. One is interested in these thoughts, in these plans, in these conjectures, because one senses happiness in them, delight in them. Be careful of karma vitakka. For many meditators, it is a major obstacle, a major part of the hindrance. So this first hindrance is not about the great pleasures of the sense world, the pleasures of being with the opposite sex, the pleasures of food, the pleasures of movies or TVs or whatever. Those aspects of the first hindrance we know very well, and we should know when those are present in the mind. But even when those are absent, we still have this karma vitakka, this thinking and planning and conjecturing, all caught up with finding comfort in the world of the five senses. And that's including the comfort of our physical body. Even though one can give up the sounds and sights, tastes and smells, sometimes the comfort of the physical body is one of the hardest of the five sense realms to abandon. The body is always looking for pleasure. And that pleasure, again, is not just the great pleasures of the beautiful food or sensory touch through sexuality. It is just the comfort of being away from these aches, these pains, these cold, these heat, this itch. This being, trying to find comfort in just the physical posture and position. All of the disturbances which come up trying to find comfort in the body, this is also part of karma chanda. The only way that one can get beyond this karma chanda is by abandoning, letting go, by seeing that there can never be any comfort found in the body. There can never be any beauty found in the world of sight. There can never be any pleasure found in the world of sound. Whatever pleasure there is, it's not stable. Not only is it unstable, but however much pleasure the mind eats from the sensory world, it gains hunger afterwards. The Buddha described the first hindrance as someone being in debt. As soon as one eats the sensory pleasure, and in Pali they use the word paribhunjati for eating the sensory pleasures. It's the same word, the same root word, bhunjati, to eat food. If one devours the sensory pleasures, then simply because the mind has experienced a particular type of sukha at that time, afterwards it has to experience dukkha. It's in debt. It's loss. It's a negative balance on the sheet. And you notice that if you experience pleasure at any time, as soon as that pleasure has disappeared, there's that sense of loss, the sense of deprivation, the sense of now it is not as happy as it was. Now I've lost something. Now I am in debt. It is one of the dangers of sensory pleasure. People only see the happiness which it affords in the moment, at the time, never realizing what has to be paid off later. Whenever you indulge in a sensory pleasure, at the very least, there is the pain of its loss once it disappears. One is in debt. One has something to pay off. One has taken happiness more than is one's due. And one has to pay for it with unhappiness afterwards. There's one reason why the Buddha gave this simile of someone being in debt. If they seek fulfillment in the world of the five senses. And so the Buddha said, be one who is free of debt. Be one who does not owe anything to the world of the five senses. Be someone who can leave them alone. Be someone who can more than leave them alone. Be someone who sees the danger in the world of the five senses. Sees the danger so much that one can have nibbida, this not just apathy, but just, there was a word which I was using the other day, I cannot recall it now, this almost aversion and disgust. So it's antipathy, was the word I was looking for, this antipathy towards the world of the five senses. And once one develops that antipathy to the world of the five senses, the result of that antipathy would be that which we call viveka, seclusion from the world of the five senses. One either goes to that world or one recedes away from it. If one goes towards that world, one is going away from viveka, from seclusion. One is going away from the peace of the mind. And one is going into the confusion, entanglements of the world. If one is going to overcome this first hindrance, one has to see the danger in the world of the five senses. To see the danger to the point where that given the chance, given half the chance, you will recede away from it. That you will run away from the places where the lay people are. You will run away from the places where the world of the five senses are displayed. You will tend to hide in your huts, to go to the quiet places, the secluded places, the forests and the caves, where the world of the five senses is not so loud and not so demanding of attention. This is viveka. This is seclusion. And that seclusion, that viveka, is born of nibbida, born of the antipathy towards these things. If you just have equanimity, you find yourself lingering around the kitchen and the dining room. If you have nibbida, you will move away from it. That is encouraged in this monastery. That was encouraged by the Buddha, to find that viveka. The viveka is the opposite of karma chanda. Eventually, the viveka has its own happiness. The nekama sukha, the happiness of renunciation, paviveka sukha, the happiness of full renunciation, full seclusion. And this is like the happiness which one gets when this hindrance is fully overcome. Once this hindrance is fully overcome, one is not concerned at all with the eye, with the ear, with the nose, with the taste. One isn't even concerned with the body. The sign that karma chanda has been overcome in its coarser form is that the five senses disappear. That the sense of touch disappears to the point where one isn't feeling the body. Because one has removed one's interest in finding comfort in this physical form. And as soon as one removes the interest for long enough, as soon as the mind doesn't pay any attention to what's happening in the arms, the legs, the back, or wherever, one gets the first feeling of this viveka sukha. At least the coarser form has been overcome. The more refined form is that which is with the thought, the karma vitakka. And again, this is almost like the echo or the shadow of the five sense world. This shadow inside your mind. To overcome that as well, let go of that. Do not give way to fantasy, to dreams, to memories about the five sense world. Again, if you do, this is still the refined part of karma chanda that needs to be overcome. To the point where you're not concerned at all with the world of the five senses. You're just concerned with the world of the mind, this sixth sense. If one can overcome the hindrances, if one can overcome especially this first one, karma chanda, one can go to the world of pure mind. And once a meditator, not many people in the world do this. Many people think they're in the mind, but this is just the shadow, the echo of the five sense world. It's all thinking about the five sense world. Philosophers do this. One needs to go beyond the five-sense world and thinking about the five-sense world before one comes to the world of pure mind. Until one realizes and understands through one's own experience what we mean by mind. Citta. Once one realizes through one's own experience, because the five-sense world has completely disappeared, you know what mind is, you know the world of mind. When you start to understand the creatures, the phenomena, the things which arise and pass away in this great world of the citta, and you realize sometimes how difficult it is to find names for these experiences. Weird and wonderful, but usually very beautiful. Very beautiful because the world of the five senses is such a heavy burden. Once that is dropped, one can go to the world of the mind. That's viveka sukha, paviveka sukha, nikama sukha. The sukha, the happiness of renunciation, the happiness of seclusion. That first hindrance is one of the most difficult to overcome. The second hindrance, the obstacle, is far easier to overcome. That second obstacle is the ill will, the vayapada. The ill will, which is specifically stated to be towards a person or a thing, the wishing to destroy that person or the thing. This comes about through one's frustration finding happiness in the world of the five senses. And the objects in the world of the five senses which frustrates one's happiness. If one is not careful, one develops ill will towards those things, blaming those things, thinking that those things cause one's frustration and disappointment. The ill will is an easier of the hindrance to overcome simply because it is coarse in its very nature. And as a coarse thing, it should be easy to locate. The way to overcome that particular hindrance, which the Buddha described in a simile in the Samanyapala Sutta, is of someone being sick. It is a sickness, having this anger or ill will. And it is a sickness which one has to overcome for oneself. Either by developing this wide mind of loving kindness, which doesn't look for the faults in others, but which just wishes them well. In the standard phrase, even if someone is sawing you limb by limb with a two-handed saw, you wish them well. You wish them so well that you may wish that they don't even gain blisters as they're sawing you. Wishing them happiness. So that no way can ill will enter your mind. If that doesn't work, one can reflect on the law of karma. That one does not need to be the executioner, to be the one who delivers the punishment of their bad deed or bad speech towards you. Karma comes around by itself. If someone has indeed been worthy of what you think is ill will, if someone has done something which has been hurtful by body, speech and mind, deliberately so, they will get their result according to the law of karma. One can leave all punishment or revenge, and ill will is just revenge. One can leave revenge to the law of karma. The law of karma will sort it out for you. You can leave ill will behind and just go and play around in the world of jhanas. The third hindrance is sloth and torpor. And the Buddha said that this is like someone being in prison. If there is sloth and torpor, just the mind just has no ability just to move. It's confined to a very small cell. nothing might be happening in that very small cell. You may be just left there for hours on end, but it's still a cell, a small place, and the mind cannot go out to the great freedoms of jhanas. This is one of the hardest of the hindrances to overcome, the sloth and torpor. It is overcome through the generation of effort. And that is generated by yourself through wise consideration, such as through reflecting on impermanence, on the passage of time going so fast, on the closeness of one's death, of one's old age, and one's weakness due to sickness. It is overcome through the reflection that just lingering here in this world is so dangerous and so low. And there before me is the opportunity as a monk in a good monastery with good teachings. There is the opportunity for me to do much more. One arouses this will, this energy, this desire to achieve. One overcomes sloth and torpor through the arousing of desire. If one tries to let go and overcome and abandon all desire of whatever shape or form, one will be a victim of sloth and torpor. There are desires and aspirations which are praised by the Buddha. These are those which lead to Samma Samadhi, to jhanas. These are those which lead to enlightenment, to the four stages of enlightenment. And these are desires which one has to know, which one has to cultivate, in order that one has the means by which energy can be aroused. One arouses energy in order to attain that which you have yet to attain, to realize that which you've yet to realize, to reach that which you've yet to reach. Once that energy starts to be aroused, then sloth and torpor are abandoned. The gates of the prison are forced open, and one can escape and be free. Free to get the goal which one aims for. Sometimes that in prison the aim is to break your will. To escape from prison you have to arouse that will, the will to achieve. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and worry. The worry is the remorse I was talking about earlier. Remorse due to one's failure to keep one's resolutions, to keep one's goals, to keep one's aims, to keep the virtue and the rules which one has decided and promised to keep. There's only one way to overcome that remorse. And that is just to keep the virtue, to get up early in the morning, to do what you're supposed to do in the monastery, and to put forth the effort so that at the end of the day you have no remorse, you've lived a good day, you put forth the effort and energy and you have not allowed the mind to wallow in the defilements. And then the next morning when you got up, you will still have that lack of remorse as long as you get up at the right and early time. The worry is that remorse. The restlessness, again, is harder to overcome. This is the causer of the defilements, of the hindrances. And this restlessness, one can understand, it is caught up with either, well, caught up with the first two hindrances. In particular, caught up with the world of the sense, the five senses. If one can truly overcome the world of the five senses, the only restlessness one has left is the restlessness towards the world of the mind. But first of all, the restlessness to the world of the five senses. The only way that one can overcome this is first of all to gain this sense of like inner peace, inner confidence. To let go of that restlessness. To be disinterested in it. And to aim the mind towards peace, towards stillness. In particular, the samatha is that which calms down the restlessness. That restlessness was described by the Buddha as someone being in slavery, always being ordered around by the master or the mistress. Go here, come there, bring that, do that. Because the restlessness feels like that. Again, it gives one no freedom. All these orders being given to you, all this movement of the mind which one cannot stop. One just sits there and it's just out of control. You're a slave to the restlessness. One powerful way of overcoming that restlessness is to look elsewhere. Not to pay attention to it, but to pay attention to a point of peace beyond and outside of that restlessness. Again, if one knows the world of the mind, if one has experienced jhanas before, if one knows the value and the beauty of stillness, now one can recognize the world of restlessness to be a great pain and a burden. One will remove one's interest from it, and one will look elsewhere to peace. However, even though one abandons the restlessness concerned with the world of the five senses, there is still the restlessness concerned with the world of the mind. And this restlessness concerned with the mind is the last aspect of the hindrances one will overcome before one enters a jhana. The restlessness concerned with one's samadhi nimitta, the mental object. That restlessness, that agitation, is overcome in that stage in the Anapanasati Sutta where one calms the kaya sankhara, where one makes the effort of will or choice or aspiration, whatever you wish to call it, a very refined and gentle and subtle movement of the mind to calm that which one is conscious of, that which one is sustaining the consciousness on, to stop its wobbling, to stop its agitation, to settle it down. In my experience, that's the only way that that last piece of restlessness is fully settled down. And it is why if the mind has many objects coming and going, even though all the other five hindrances are overcome and just this last agitation on the world of the mind, this last bit of udacha, that is still a hindrance and one will not be able to see clearly. Again, this is one of the reasons why a state that such a thing called kanika samadhi or momentary samadhi is not really free yet from the hindrances. The mind is still moving. The mind is still under the power of restlessness. The last of the hindrances is that which we call doubt. And that doubt is not knowing what one should be doing. And again, this is one of the main reasons why people do not into jhana. One of those aspects of doubt is thinking that jhana is not possible, or that it's not necessary, or that one can get around entering jhana and do something else. Doubt is overcome either from one of two things, either through faith in the Buddha's teachings. The faith in the Buddha's teachings means one takes what the Buddha said and takes it without bending the meaning. To look, to read, and not just to pick and choose from what the Buddha said, but to see the whole, to take the whole and see the obvious meaning. The faith in the Buddha is the faith that the Buddha's Dhamma was Suvākhāta, was perfectly proclaimed in its letter and in its spirit. That the Buddha was articulate, that he made it clear what he meant to be said, and that he was the unexcelled teacher. The unexcelled means that neither commentator nor monk can do any better than the teacher. They cannot even equal the articulate and perfect expression of the Dhamma by the Lord Buddha. It's that degree of faith in the teachings of the Buddha which is one of the ways which doubt can be overcome. The teachings about the way to enter jhana, the teachings of its necessity, the teachings about the overcoming of the five hindrances were all pointed out over and over again. If one has faith in the teachings of the Buddha to that degree, that hindrance will be overcome. Or, even better, or I don't know if it's better, it's just equal really, is one's own experience. To have, maybe through faith or maybe just through muddling through and finding the path, what, through chance or maybe through the fortune of one's accumulated merits from the past, one gains a jhana. One gains it not just once but many times. And one realizes the path into that sublime state. And one realizes its usefulness. And so one does not fear it. That little phrase I said at the beginning of the talk, jhānaṁ na bhayitabhaṁ, was mentioned by the Buddha, that jhāna is not to be feared. It's worthwhile and it's useful. It's of great benefit. If one has achieved a jhāna several times, one just knows through experience the benefits of it. Not only that, but one knows the ways into that jhana. One knows what one needs to do, what the obstacles are. And there one has truly overcome doubt. The doubt, the Buddha was saying, is like someone lost in a desert, not knowing the way through that desert. That desert is the metaphor for the world outside of jhana. If you've been born in the desert, raised in the desert, lived in the desert all your life, you take the desert as your natural home. If you go through that desert to the other side and see the lush and comfortable territory beyond the desert, you realize that the world of jhana is the world of freedom from these five senses is indeed far superior than living in a dry, hot and arid desert. But the way through that desert is the hard thing to know. And if one has overcome doubt, one knows the way through the desert, away from the world of the five senses, into citta viveka, the seclusion of the mind. So these are the five hindrances which one has to notice and overcome in order to enter a jhana, in order to do the satipatthana, as is mentioned quite clearly in the Anguttara Nikaya. One has to overcome five hindrances first before one can do Satipatthana. As is said very often, that all the arahats, past and future, have entered that state having overcome the five hindrances first. So these five hindrances should be known very well. And one should know whether those five hindrances are present or not through the ability to enter a jhana. This is the great test of their being overcome. If they are indeed overcome, and this becomes the first task in doing meditation, the preliminary task can be called as the overcoming of the five hindrances. And once the five hindrances are overcome, then one can do the samma part of samadhi. And as I was mentioning, to point the mind onto a samadhi nimitta. This samadhi nimitta is a thing of the mind. If you're going to enter the world of the mind, you can only do so on an object which is born of mind, not an object born of the other five senses. Be careful if it's a nimitta made of light or out of sound, because those nimittas of light or sound, they can be a preliminary nimitta, but the nimitta which is going to take you into samadhi has to be its equivalent, the way the mind perceives this, the way the mind is conscious of this. And as soon as a samadhi nimitta arises, one of its main signs, the main thing which accompanies its arising, is great piti and sukha, the great happiness and joy which is born of the mind putting its attention away from the world of the five senses. A mind which is freed from the world of the five senses because the bonds, the cords of the hindrances have been temporarily untied. And once the five hindrances, these cords which tie one to the world of the five senses, have been released, and the mind sees the samadhi nimitta, the thing born of mind, and experiences the happiness and joy which is born of a mind of the attention separated from the world of the five senses, which is born of viveka, which is born of seclusion, aloofness from the world which most people inhabit, then that piti, that sukha, that happiness of the mind, not of the body but of the mind, is what will take you into the jhanas. That piti sukha is refined. It's a different sort than the piti sukha concerned with the body, concerned with the world of the five senses. This is a refined part of refined piti sukha. Again, the words we use for the mind, we use similar words, taking them, lifting them out from the world of the five senses, because that's all we've got to use. The piti sukha of the mind is of a different quality. Very often that meditators describe it as peace, as emptiness, as stillness, as a great depth or even blackness. Again, these are all just words which the work which we call perception just tries desperately just to grasp on, to give this experience some name, some word, so that we can somehow understand it. After a while, we just use the word piti sukha, born of detachment. And however that appears to the mind, we know it as a thing of the mind, a phenomena of the mind, which has parallels to the world of the five senses, but which is not the same as things of the world of the five senses. This is the piti sukha of the mind. And that piti sukha of the mind just grabs the attention, and the attention just goes there into that piti sukha of the mind and stays there. It is the piti sukha, the very pleasurable mental feeling, which keeps the attention stuck on the image, on the samadhi nimitta, on the sign of samadhi. And it remains there almost effortlessly. The almost effortless piti sukha is what we call first jhana, where the mind just stays for a long time, experiencing the deep peace, the deep happiness of being free from the world of the five senses, free of the body, free of sound, free of sight, smell or whatever. If it can go deeper, then that almost effortless becomes effortless. That is what is called the first arising of true samadhi. True samadhi in the sense of being truly one-pointed of mind. That one-pointed of mind of the second jhana, when they say that the mind is inwardly composed, ajatang sampasadang, I think it is, inwardly sort of pleased with itself. It doesn't seek for anything outside of itself. So much so that it doesn't even move from itself. The mind is in the mind. The citta has got one pointed at last. Once there is one pointed, it is truly effortless, because the effort is just the mind trying to go on to the mind. When there's no effort, the mind is in the mind. When the mind is in the mind, it brings forth the deep peace and satisfaction. Another type of piti sukha yet, which is far different than the piti sukha of viveka, the first jhana, and just light years different than the piti sukha of the world. And this is the piti sukha born of samadhi. And there one just resides, immobile, just drinking the happiness, the peace of just one pointedness of mind, not understanding the passage of time, not perceptive of the passage of time, not perceptive of any diversity, just the perception of the happiness and peace born of samadhi. The only way that one can truly understand first jhana is by attaining second jhana. It is as if the only way that one could see the layout of the city of Perth, say, is to go up on that hill, which we call King's Park, to get out and above it so we can look over it. And then we can start to see it from a distance, almost like a bird's eye view. In a similar way that the second jhana gives like a bird's eye view. This is not a literal metaphor. This is just in a certain way. The second jhana can give you a bird's eye view of the first jhana. Once the true one-pointedness of mind has been achieved, one can understand what really makes first jhana and what one really means by still the almost effortless one-pointedness of mind. That almost effortless is what we mean by the vitakka vichara, which one may call a wobbling of the mind, but the wobbling just to and fro the samadhi nimitta, not going far enough away that it leaves the mind and goes into the world of the five senses. To experience samadhi is a marvelous thing. Samadhi, I'm talking about the second jhana. It gives one, again, a deep and powerful insight into the nature of citta, of mind, of citta which is untainted by the world of the five senses. A citta in its first degree of purity. And it really tells one a lot about the dukkha and suffering of the world of the five senses, and tells one a lot about the happiness and the peace of the anagami, the non-returner, and the joys of the sudhavasa, the pure abodes, pure. Again, if one practices samadhi, one has to go deeper yet. One has to give up a part of the happiness of this one-pointedness. And it's only when one enters a third jhana, one gets an idea of the meaning of pity. Before, up to the second jhana, the pity and sukha have been so close together that it's almost impossible, in my experience, I'd say it is impossible to distinguish between them. Even though some commentaries or maybe even the texts describe one as mental, the other as physical, one as sort of a sankhara, the other one as a vedana, in different khandhas, sort of experientially it's almost impossible to distinguish these things. However, in third jhana one has the experience, the weird experience, that what one sees is just sukha. It's a different type of piti sukha altogether. It's a sukha with its usual component, something which has always been seen in its company for the first time in one's experience, gone. And one understands what sukha is. Sukha without pity. And this is actually a stage in the quietening of the mind, and a weird stage. All these stages are weird on reflection. They're only weird after one emerges. When one's in them, one isn't concerned at all whether they're weird or not. They're weird in the sense that these are things of the mind which bear very little resemblance to the things of the world. And again, just enjoying that sukha, that happiness is just what the mind is conscious of. Again and again and again and again. The smooth flow of sukha consciousness. All of the mind. And the fourth jhana even goes deeper yet. But even that sukha disappears. One is left with true equanimity of mind. Equanimity here being like a concept, a mental phenomena, a thing purely of the mind, and a thing which one only understands in its fullness and purity in that experience. One can have ideas of these things, conceptions of these things when one hasn't achieved them, but the achievement in itself is always different than one imagined it to be. So don't think too much of these things, because the experience will always surprise you when one sees these things as they truly are. But just the words, the descriptions, are useful as signposts. When one goes into these things and say, ah, that's what the Buddha meant by a mind which is just as sukha, which is the happy abiding of the Aryas. Ah, this is what the Buddha meant when the purity, the perfection of sati and upekkha. This is the fourth jhana. These four jhanas are investigating and exploring the territory of the mind. Going deep in that territory by leaving the other territory, the desert. At the very least, if one has heard the teachings of the Buddha and one has a sharp mind, that emerging from those states, especially if one has entered those states again and again and again and again and has familiarity with the territory, at the very least one should get a very profound insight and understanding into the nature of equanimity, into the nature of sukha, in the nature of samadhi, and in the nature of viveka. These very important words, which from the standpoint of the unexperienced are just words, which we can apply to things which don't deserve those words, which we can apply to things and think that's what viveka means, that's what piti and sukha means, that's what equanimity means, but we're mistaking and fooling ourselves. If you've experienced fourth jhana, then you know what equanimity means. If you experience fourth jhana, then you know what sati means. If you experience third jhana, you know what sukha, and thereby piti sukha, means. If you experience second jhana, you know what samadhi, one-pointedness, means. If you experience first jhana, you know what viveka truly means. These are things of the mind. You have to go into the mind and leave the rest of the world to understand these things. So by overcoming those five hindrances, obstacles to insight, obstacles to quietness, one calms the sensory apparatus so much that the five external senses cut off completely. And even the shadow of those five senses cuts off completely, the karma vitaka. And one goes into the world of the mind. This is the happy abiding for the monastic. This is where the Buddha dwelt after he was enlightened, where the arahats dwell, the happy abiding here and now, which is of enormous benefit. I will end with the quote from the Pasadika Sutta, where the Buddha said that anyone who indulges paribhujati, eats, enjoys, devours these four jhanas, the four things are to be expected of them. And the four things are the attainment of the Sotapanna, the stream enterer, the second fruit and benefit, pala and anisangsa, anisong in Thai, the second anisong, Thai word, is the Sakadagami, the once returning, the third pala and anisangsa is the fruit of non-return or anagami, and if you don't get those three fruits, you'll get the last, the arahat, fully enlightened. These are the pala, the anisangsa, the fruits, the benefits that someone who indulges, eats, devours, feeds on the four jhanas, if they have the teachings of the Buddha to inform them of right view. So this evening I've given a talk about the five hindrances and their relevance in the practice of meditation, and how one proceeds having abandoned them, to be careful of that last hindrance of the restlessness on the mental object, or that last manifestation of the five hindrances, and how one turns these into jhanas and the benefits thereof. May this be of use to you. in knowing these hindrances so that you can overcome them and know that you've overcome them. Is there any comment or question anyone would like to ask about this evening's Dhamma talk? Okay, we'll end now then.